You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Derek Beaulieu. He's talking to me from Canada. Derek, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Derek, let's talk about what you're working on now. I know you're going to read some poetry, but what is it that you're working on at the moment?
Well, I just finished editing the complete fiction of Canadian poet B.P. Nichol. B.P. Nichol passed away in 1988, and his fiction faded from view, while his poetry has stayed very much in the critical eye as a very generative and generous poet who did everything from concrete poetry through to writing for Fraggle Rock for Jim Henson. And throughout his career, he also wrote four novels and collections and two collections of short stories. So I've just finished editing and promoting that book that came out of Toronto's Coach House Books. And I'm currently working on a long-term project as well, which is I'm rewriting by hand, transcribing by hand, every page of James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, one page at a time.
To be clear about what you're saying, the James Joyce transcription, are you saying that you're not translating, you're not interpreting, you are handwriting in cursive or print, page for page, letter by letter, of the book Ulysses onto other pages of paper?
No, close. Basically, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, as James Joyce was writing Finnegan's Wake, he was slowly going blind. And he actually notoriously wrote some sections in chalk on a blackboard, so it was big enough that he could read it. And so what I'm actually doing is creating a series of drawings whereby I'm using a technique called blind contour drawing, where you look at your source, so whether that be you're drawing a coffee cup or, in this case, a page of text, your eyes are fixed on the source while your hand is on a separate page, where you try to match your eye movements with the movements of your hand, which often means that the resultant drawing is off kilter unless you have an extensive amount of training to keep your hand-eye coordination deeply honed. So I'm essentially drawing every page of text in Finnegan's Wake, Joyce's notorious book that takes place, basically uses the music and language of dreams, his dark book, to hand draw each page. The resultant texts are pencil on paper. They flow and mold over each other into this kind of dreamlike landscape of flowing and overlapping text. I'm about 280 pages into Joyce's approximately 400-page manuscript. A lot of people profess to have read Finnegan's Wake. It is a notoriously difficult book to read. By the end of this project, I will have read every page, and I will have handwritten every page as well.
So that's fascinating to me for a number of reasons, but because you're interacting with that text in a visual and literary and cognitive way, but you're also producing what seems like a kind of an epic piece of work. I mean, this is enormous amount of drawing that you have there. How long has it taken you so far to get to 200 pages?
About a year and a half so far. I would like to be at the pace of at least a page a day. Unfortunately, my day job as director of literary arts at the Banff Center means that my productive hours are a little less fulsome as they used to be. But that's my aim, is that it probably will take another year to year and a half to finish this. And what I'll be left with is a visual arts piece that is somewhat readable. It's a record of reading. It's a durational piece of writing where the process becomes more important than the product.
Yes, that's fascinating. So to talk a little bit more about the process, it's interesting to me because you happen to be being interviewed by a person who's also an artist, and I also spent a full year hand transcribing the Book of Job like a medieval monk. And I wasn't doing what you're doing, but what I found is that spending a year with a text letter by letter, it was also kind of swimming in my head daily. It was a type of study that I wasn't expecting and hadn't encountered before. You're kind of immersed in that text the way no one else is because of the process that you're doing, it sounds like to me. So
yeah.
Is that the case? And if so, what are some of your, it could be just overtones. I'm sure there's tons you could say, but some of your feelings, overtones of being midway through this process and completely immersed in this text in a way that probably very few people in history have ever been immersed in this text.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. Absolutely. The process of creating this is very much in line with some of my previous projects, which end up being long durational writing practices that look a lot more like something else. They look like reading or they look like drawing. And it's teaching me a great deal about, first of all, about my own body, you know, like the bodily awareness when you do this kind of durational practice becomes very intriguing. You start feeling every finger, your wrists, your elbows, your shoulders, the tension in your neck, the strain on your eyes. It becomes a very physical process in ways that I think a lot of authors don't pay attention to. They marginalize the fact that writing is something that takes place in your body, not just in your mind or in your fingertips. And then as well, the way I've been reading Finnegan's Wake, I'm not studying it per se. I'm not trying to elucidate sections or make them become more clear. It is a reading practice, but it's teaching me to read in a totally different way. It has to be very active, very embodied reading. If I start to scan or drift off the page, the resultant product, the drawing, reflects that. It needs me to be aware of every word I'm reading. And with the interesting thing with Finnegan's Wake is that for the most part, that text is not written in a language that we recognize as clear English. There's a lot of portmanteaus, a lot of nonsense words that have been made by putting other languages together. The sentences in the book are long and like I said, and dreamlike. There's shifting narratives and shifting landscapes, and it becomes a way of enforcing my reading, making me read, but also making me think about every page as I go. And, you know, Finnegan's Wake has become incredibly funny. It's become a beautifully sonic book. You start seeing rhymes. You start seeing how the language is unfolding. You can start seeing his play, and it's taught me a ton about how sentences work.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And what will happen with these works, as with other durational works of this type of yours? Are they exhibited? Are they sold? What happens to these works? What do you imagine?
Well, I think that's a good question. Often, so my last few projects, I tend to start a writing project, and I take this inspiration from writers like my good friend Kenneth Goldsmith, who has suggested things like, when I start writing this project, or when I start working on a project like this, if I recognize it as writing right off the bat, if I can say, is this writing or is this poetry, if I'm not sure of the answer, then that's the project I want to continue. If I'm not even sure if it's writing at all, then this is where I want to live, because that to me really challenges not only my practice, but my assumptions around my practice, my assumptions around my role, and my assumptions about how this project will come into the world. So I don't know if this will be published. I don't know if this will be exhibited. For me right now, it's a big puzzle, and I'll discover those things at the end. Somewhere along the closer to the end of the project, I'll start realizing, you know, what it needs to look like when finished. And I've learned that lesson. My previous novel, the novel called A Novel, whereby I erased all of the text except the punctuation marks and the automatopoeia from Andy Warhol's book, A Novel, which came out in 1968. So I was left with a 400-page novel with no words. And I had no idea how it would be published or what form it would take. And yet, upon its completion, a press in Paris, Jean Boite, happily published it in a 400-page tombstone of a book that they were very happy to endorse. So I'll let the final exhibition or publication of this project, you know, happen afterwards. I think that if I spend too much time worrying about what form it will take, I'll focus on that and less on the process. It will become too much like it has to look like a book or it has to look like an exhibit, as opposed to it has to be a reading of this text.
Right, that makes sense. And it's also fascinating. So you're going to read a bit today. I'd love to hear the first piece that you have prepared to read, and if you could tell me a little bit about what you are going to read.
Sure. I thought that I would start by reading a short poem, actually, by B.P. Nichols. So as I said, I recently edited his collected fiction, and this particular poem is called A Small Song That Is His, and to me embodies my excitement about engaging with poetry at the level of the letter. So this is A Small Song That Is His by B.P. Nichols. A door, a door, a door, a door, an opening, an O, an H, a leg, a table, or a window, and a W, a sky that is D, a lake that is F, E. D-E-F, F-F-F-F, D-D, E-E-E, D-F-F, E-F-F, F-E-F-E, me, you or me, or I, H, and D, M-E, E-F-D-O, D-F-H-E-W, F, F-E-W-H-D, O, W-D, F. So with that particular poem, Nichol has made the subject of poetry letters themselves, and letting letters be, try to carry the emotional weight of words. And this poem to me just embodies that excitement that I feel when I try to write. I want to let letters, not necessarily words or sentences or phrases or stanzas, but letters express themselves and just fall into the that logo-like openness to allowing letters to be expressive.
And isn't that also called concrete poetry then, or is that something separate, do you think? I mean, what you just read sounds like concrete poetry, but is it,
well, I mean,
would you consider it not?
Thing. This particular poem is not a concrete poem. It looks and behaves like a lyric poem. I mean, it's text. I haven't modified a poetic reading to try to interpret a text that's on the page. I've read exactly what's on the page. And that's the interesting thing. It's like this suggests a way of reading concrete that separates it from sound poetry, so from the work of, you know, Yap Blanc or any contemporary sound poet, where you're trying to be sonically experimental. So the poem is not, ooh, but, you know, this is actually just the letters themselves. It's a lyric poem. It's a love poem to letters. And Nichol was a well-known concrete poet, and so you can see that influence in this piece. But I think what excites me here is that he's taking the thinking of concrete poetry, that attention at the level of mm-hmm. letter or punctuation or syntax, and is applying it to a lyric voice.
And there's another piece that you're going to read, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that and read it?
Sure. This this piece is I was asked a few years ago to write a manifesto about poetry, and so I came up with this short prose piece called "Please No More Poetry." I joke that it's a manifesto, but as I'm Canadian, it starts with the word "please." So this is "Please No More Poetry." Poetry is the last refuge of the unimaginative. Poetry has little to offer outside of poetry itself. Poets choose to be poets because they do not have the drive to become something better. Readers are a book's aphorisms. All bad poetry springs from genuine feeling. To be natural is to be obvious, and to be obvious is to be inartistic. Poetry sadly knows it's poetry, while writing doesn't always know it's writing. Art is a conversation, not a patent office. Poets in ostrich-like ignorance of the potential of sharing, as opposed to hoarding, their texts are ignoring potentially the most important artistic innovation of the 20th century, collage. What's at stake? Nothing but their own obsolescence. If you don't share, you don't exist. We expect plumbers, electricians, engineers, and doctors to both have a specific and specialized vocabulary and be on the forefront of new advancements in their field, but we scorn poets who do the same. Poets are now judged not by the quality of their writing, but by the infallibility of their choices. Having been unpopular in high school is not just cause for book publication. Immature poets imitate, mature poets steal. In theory, there is no difference between theory and practice, but in practice, there is. Rules are guidelines for stupid people. In poetry, we celebrate mediocrity and ignore radicality. Poetry has more to learn from graphic design, engineering, architecture, cartography, automotive design, or any other subject. Poets should not be told to write what they know. They don't know anything. That's why they're poets. The internet is not something that challenges who we are or how we write. It is who we are and how we write. Poets, being poets, are simply the last to realize the fact. If writing a poem is inherently tragic, it is because it's hard to believe that the author had nothing better to do. It's inherently tragic because we still choose an outdated form as a medium for argumentation. If we had something to say, why would we choose the poem, with its sliver of audience and lack of cultural cachet, as the arena to announce that opinion? Please, no more poetry.
Thank you, Derek. That's a wonderful piece of writing. Yeah, I'm smiling as you're reading that, and it makes me wonder if and where that was published, because I would imagine if it was published online, there would be quite a few comments on a piece like that.
Yeah, I mean it's circulated around. It's been on the internet, and funnily enough, a few years back, a couple years ago, a press in Canada, Wilfrid Laurier University Press, published a selected volume of my work, and it was entitled "Please No More Poetry: The Poetry of Derek Beaulieu," which was an invitation for critics to use the title as a means to dismiss the volume itself. It is a snarky manifesto, but it's meant as a love letter. It's meant as a challenge, as an invitation to let poetry be more inclusive, more contemporary, more strange than I think that we believe that it can be. I want a poetry that looks like, you know, like I say, like cartography and automotive design and logos and slogans. I want something that looks, I challenge my students that here they are, young writers in the 21st century, they should be writing a poetry that I don't even recognize. I don't even see the poetic in it. It should be so of this moment. And I think that that's where poets should live. They should live in the spaces that make something so contemporary that it's barely even seen as writing. That's our responsibility to the form.
I like that. I think that's of course very similar to how, you know, visual artists see or should be seeing the form as well, I believe. And Let's hear one more from you. I know you have one more piece to read, and I'd love to hear about that and hear you read it.
Sure. I have a piece here on contemporary work that's coming out. It's just been published by Ugly Duckling Press in Brooklyn by my colleague Rob Fitterman. And Rob Fitterman has just put out this book from Ugly Duckling called Rob's Word Shop. So for May 2010, Rob Fitterman hosted a storefront facility in New York's Bowery that sold nothing but words. Rob's Word Shop was open Tuesdays and Thursdays, May 5th through May 27th, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., selling single letters for 50 cents and words for a buck apiece. Clients were invited to request letters and words and specify which typeface, typed or handwritten, in printing or cursive, in which they would like these words produced. Fitterman then created the requested letters, words, phrases, and sentences to the client's specifications, produced an invoice and commercial documentation, and completed the sale. All requests and conversations were recorded, and all purchases obsessively detailed fodder for his new book. Fitterman also allowed for mail order requests and posted daily updates on his company's success at rodswordshop.blogspot.com. Needless to say, I couldn't miss the opportunity to participate in a venture that stands the traditional writing publishing model on its head. I placed an email order for the second last sentence in Herman Melville's novella, Bartleby the Scrivener. On errands of life, these letters speed towards death. I dutifully sent Fitterman a check for $9 U.S. and promptly received an envelope containing the requested sentence, handwritten horizontally across a standard sheet of paper, rubber-stamped and signed by Fitterman. Accompanying the sentence was an itemized invoice stamped, "Keep this slip for your reference," and a typed alternate setting of the same sentence at no charge. At the outset of Melville's novella, Bartleby is a model employee, highly praised by his superiors. He soon, however, refuses to participate in any of the expected duties of his office and of society. Bartleby begins to respond to demands that he dutifully execute his role as scrivener, hand-copying business documents, with the phrase, "I would prefer not to." This lack of participation soon spreads to all aspects of Bartleby's life, and he eventually dies, preferring not to eat. I requested that particular sentence, as many poets adopt Bartleby the Scrivener as a stylistic forerunner to writing. Writing that prefers not to engage with the expectations of writing as it is traditionally defined. It eschews traditional formulations of literature, echoing Bartleby, consisting of works that are unreadable, unsellable, unreviewable, and ultimately outside of traditional definitions. Fitterman, with Rob's Word Shop, was a writer who refused to write. He welcomed the position of scrivener, preferring not to express any of his own creativity. Instead, he accepted commissions for creative writing. Fitterman merely transcribed words at his customers' request and charged them for a task that they could have easily accomplished without him. Ironically, given the sales of poetry, especially that of avant-garde poetry, Fitterman's Word Shop probably moved more product than most poets. If Rob's Word Shop is any indication, readers today do not want to purchase poetry. They would rather purchase their own words sold back to them at a profit.
Thank you, Derek. Love that piece too, and that's kind of fascinating, and not unlike the last piece, and even what you were mentioning about students, that this also addresses your perspective on the form itself, right, and how you're approaching it and see it.
Yeah, well, I believe that poetry is actually an incredibly rich and fertile space. It's incredibly open. It's incredibly enabling. It's incredibly welcoming of difference, of challenge, of strangeness, of experimentation, of risk. And I want poets to meet that challenge, to risk failure, do things that may not be successful, take challenges that, you know, may be dead ends or may be offensive or may be problematic as a means of us discovering
what are the edges of our understanding of what poetry can be and what can it do?
I love the idea of publishing novels I don't know how to read,
or creating poems that live on the page but seem to struggle and lurch when they are vocalized.
I love the idea that other people know how to read work that I don't know how to read. I've written it, but I can't figure out a way to express it.
I love the idea that poetry is a space that is made richer through sharing, through giving our work away, through thinking through community, and that through taking risk and enabling people to do strange things and to allow them to see what they think the edges of communication and beauty and language are. And I think that's the seduction of poetry.
I love that. I'm so glad you put it that way. I want to ask you one more question. It's really been wonderful hearing the work and I'm talking to you about the form itself. I always ask everybody at the end what you're reading at the moment. What are you reading at this time?
I have a number of books on the go. Right now, I've been reading a collection by Gregory Betts and Christian Book called Avant Canada, Poets, Prophets, and Revolutionaries. I'll be heading to Dublin at the end of April for a conference being put on at University College Dublin, which is about avant-garde Canadian poetic practice. And this particular volume of essays is a historical but also forward-thinking collection of writers and critics trying to discuss and formulate what comes next, what could be the corners and avenues that lead us to new poetic exploration. So I've been reading Avant Canada, Poets, Prophets, Revolutionaries by Gregory Betts and Christian Book.
Derek, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been an enormous pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure was all mine. I'm happy to do it anytime. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.